Welcome to the wrap-up. It's week 10. This is our last episode of the quarter. By the time you're listening to this, protests may or may not still be going on in Seattle. Police vehicles are burning, and chants of "I can't breathe" have been ringing through the city and the country, spurred by even more senseless deaths of Black Americans, failed by the police and the criminal justice system. We're living through a historical moment, as more and more folks demand police accountability and reform. We hope you're all safe and in reflection. I'm bringing on engagement editor Hannah Krieg to read the Daily's message to our community. I was hoping you could read to us the message that you wrote for the Daily's newsletter this week.
Yeah, let me pull up, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead and read the whole thing.
Okay. Hello, Huskies. It does not feel appropriate to begin this newsletter in our usual lighthearted manner. The Daily stands in solidarity with all those hurt by the long history of anti-Black police brutality and white supremacy in this country. We hope you are safe and taking care of yourself in these particularly troubling times. In the case of such clear and ongoing injustice, we take a page from CNN journalist Christiane Amanpour's book and remember to be truthful, not neutral. The truth is, the police have a disgraceful history of abuse, brutality, and murder that disproportionately targets Black people in the United States. The truth is, we have an evident, deeply rooted, and systemic issue of racism in this country. The truth is, these national issues are present in Seattle, at the UW, and around our kitchen tables. The truth is, if we stay silent, we are complicit in this oppression. The truth is, Black Lives Matter. We're a student newspaper. We like the First Amendment. Use this right to do good, speak out, protest, and sign petitions.
Can you tell me maybe what was going through your head or conversations you were having when you were trying to figure out what to write to the Daily's readers this week?
Yeah, so our editorial board hasn't made an official editorial about this issue just yet. And usually the newsletter is just kind of like fun, casual intro, and I felt like that wasn't right, and so I talked to our editor-in-chief, Mira, and I wrote something that was a lot shorter than that and a lot less in depth, but then we slept on it, and she saw what ASUW had put on their Instagram, and she felt it was appropriate that we say a little bit more. I wrote it the morning of, and I felt very overwhelmed and underqualified. And I think what this editorial neglects to address is that racism exists at the Daily in very real ways. And we see it in the fact that our editorial staff is mostly white. Yeah. And I think that that's, as we can say whatever we want in a newsletter and use as much woke language and as much buzzwords as we want, but it doesn't mean much until we fix the issues at home and we really get the representation we need in our editorial staff and in our writers in general to report on these issues in more meaningful ways. And I think that this little blurb doesn't address that. And I think that's a failing on my part. I think we can all see that there's a huge problem and there has been for a really long time. I think these protests are really important. And as much as it's stressful and it's hard, half a week of rioting is nothing compared to the hundreds of years of racial oppression in this country. And it's just, we all have to get out there and we all have to fight back, because we can see, it's evident in the videos, this isn't an opinion. The police are initiating violence. I'm really frustrated with how, not necessarily the Daily, because the Daily hasn't really covered a bunch on this, which is also whatever, but I'm frustrated with seeing how journalism has been covering these protests. And I know being there that the media isn't doing this right now, in largely.
Yeah.
Are you in Seattle still? Are you down there?
Yeah. I'm in Seattle right now as they're on Saturday, and there are a lot of ethical questions, I think, young journalists are facing right now, the identity as a college student, especially as someone who stands up for what is right and gets in the streets. And the identity of a journalist is someone who covers them. And there's this kind of gray area between those two. And I think this idea of truthful, not neutral, kind of gets at the heart of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think that's like what I've been struggling a lot with right now. It's just like how our this push to be objective and this expectation to be objective in journalism is really sensitive to the wrong people, you know? It's, and we see all the time in the way things are covered. It's, so we see all these things on Instagram. It's like, if you're neutral, you're on the side of the oppressor. And that is so true in journalism. If you are neutral in your reporting, you are helping the people who are already ahead and are already above people. And mm-hmm. One of my favorite tenets of journalism is to comfort the my favorite tenet of journalism is afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted, I think is how it's said. And I think that perfect objectivity and perfect neutrality, or like how, at least how we interpret that, is informed by an oppressive system, an unfair system, and therefore it helps the people who are already on top, and it doesn't achieve that of comforting the afflicted. I think that's really disheartening to see.
Yeah. There have been some older journalists within the last year who have said some kind of inspiring things to me, which is this new world of journalism is changing, and the rules and the ethics have not been written yet, and young journalists coming into the field will get to decide what those ethics are and what objectivity means to them, you know? Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, I think, and I hope, young journalists coming into the field understand that our journalism should do something. Something mm-hmm. should be the product of our journalism, you know? Otherwise, what are you in it for?
Yeah. Yeah.
Several days of protests erupted in Seattle. Reporter and photojournalist Nicole Pasilla covered some of them for The Daily. Here she is now.
I was looking at your photos paired with Beth Cassidy's article. Yeah. And, well, first of all, they're really phenomenal.
Yeah, we had a conversation, you know, to protect everyone's identity. That's the way that they want it to go with. So definitely a lot of pictures I didn't end up using, but yeah.
That's really interesting. I was having that conversation with someone because I'm seeing a lot of things on Instagram saying, do not post identifiable photos of protesters. Mm-hmm. But that seems like a huge dilemma for photojournalists.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Trust me. All of that stuff, you know, we went over in class about ethics, and it's never easy, like, especially if you're out in the field, but it's just a matter of being mindful. And obviously, like, I'm still learning all the time. I'm not perfect, but that's just part of the job, I guess. Occupational hazard.
Yeah. I feel like that decision not to identify anyone in these photos is a very different conclusion that you came to than, say, like, the Seattle Times or a lot of other publications covering yes. this.
Yes. Yeah, I know. I've been looking at their photos as well, and it's, like, obviously that's, you know, there's something else. They're amazing, like, and the way that they go through their process of, you know, deciding whether or not to photograph people identifiably is, you know, and how that impacts the story that they're trying to tell is, it's really interesting to see their process.
Yeah, and I do want to talk about specific images you captured, and maybe you have certain ones that stood out for you, if you want to talk about those.
Yeah, let's see. Going to the car on fire, obviously, like, a combination of, like, my trying to be safe, as well as, like, the limitations of my gear, I wasn't able to get a super close-up shot, but even just, like, being in the vicinity and seeing people gathered around, like, the people in that photo specifically weren't being violent, weren't, you know, they were just standing there and sharing that space with, you know, just trying to take it in, taking the gravity of the situation. And I think that's what a majority of the protesters were feeling. Like, you know, we were all here for different reasons. Some might be more, you know, well-intended than others, but just, you know, I think that was just a moment of like shock, because that was actually after the majority of the protesters walked, marched down the freeway. As we were coming back to Seattle, that's when we saw everything start to sort of descend. So it was just that pivotal moment of shock and realization. I went back to sort of Westlake Park and was listening to some of the speakers there. I was a little bit removed from more of the craziness that was going down the street.
It was very interesting how separated that was. Like how the speakers were in one kind of corner, and then right across that corner of in front of Nordstrom.
Yeah.
It was a very different scene.
You had the flash bombs going off and people shouting. You know, it was definitely a really interesting juxtaposition. And I wish, going, like, thinking back on it, I wish I would have lingered on that moment more. But yeah, you know, as the curfew went on, and people started marching once again, while others were sort of lingering and sort of at a loss of what to do, especially since, you know, all of the buses were rerouted, so it's not like people could get home easily anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there was an air of frustration around that as well. So the photos from the bridge of all the marchers as they went onto the freeway.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's a really striking image, the sheer number of people. And actually, looking back on it, you know, especially since I was under the impression of taking non-identifying photos, you know, I don't want those photos specifically to summarize the movement as a whole, because it does give that impression of, you know, all the protesters are just a sea of faces. And, you know, that's something to think about when this movement has obviously impacted all of these different people, you know, in some ways very personally. So there's that to think about when taking these photos.
Yeah.
Or at least that's something I've sort of gotten back reflecting on it.
Yeah, thinking about whether or not you're going to show people's faces, that does seem like a huge limitation of, do you lose out on people's humanity and their, like, raw emotions by not zooming in a little bit? Did you think of, you know, maybe taking those photos and then approaching those people and saying, hey, would it be okay if I use this photo? Or asking beforehand, can I take a photo of your face?
I did try that a couple of times, and, you know, those people weren't comfortable. I did have a few people yell at me to stop taking photos, and that was understandable because, you know, they were valuing their identity and their protection. And I think that's fair.
Wow. I was speaking with Hannah Krieg about how there are some publications that are framing this in kind of a harmful way and are focusing on maybe the wrong things. And I'm wondering if you are looking toward, like, either journalists or photojournalists who are doing a good job, you know, or who you're trying to listen to or turn to right now.
I really think I've been doing my best to sort of widen my scope when it comes to photographers and get as many narratives as I can, especially now. I've been trying to look towards more Black photographers, non-binary photographers, because they have valuable different perspectives, and, you know, to sort of break me out of this whitewashed, so to say, narrative that's been influencing my way of expressing and telling stories.
You can find Nicole's photos on her Twitter at Nicole A. P-A-S-I-A. Her photos accompany an article by Beth Cassidy covering Saturday afternoon's protests. Find them both on our website, dailyuw.com. I also want to take this opportunity to revisit the Daily's coverage of our own police department. Minneapolis, the city where George Floyd was killed, can seem extremely far away, but journalists across the country have been telling the same stories for decades. Maybe not of murder, but certainly stories of broken police departments, secrecy, and a lack of transparency. So it's important to remember that these issues are happening in our own backyard, too. In 2019, The Daily reported on several internal complaints lodged against UWPD's Chief John Vinson. The officers alleged that Chief Vinson created an atmosphere of hostility, retaliation, and unethical behavior. There were concerns about how Vinson treated female employees as well. An internal review was launched and ended up finding a culture of fear and retaliation. It detailed Vinson's refusal to share the department budget with other employees. Employees alleged that leadership was not background checking new hires, although the internal review was not able to verify that claim one way or another, as they weren't permitted to view personnel files. They said this was a significant limitation to their investigation. Chief Vinson stepped down right before the review came out, but he continues to serve as UW's Assistant Vice President of Campus and Community Safety. Later that year, The Daily broke the story that two UWPD employees had been arrested for domestic battery. Officer Damar Smiles and the department's crime analyst were both put on paid leave. The same day the story was published, Interim Chief Randy West put officers under a strict gag order, prohibiting UWPD employees from talking to the media. Just this year, The Daily reported on candidates for a new chief, one of which, Terrence Calloway, faced a discrimination lawsuit which ended in over $400,000 being awarded to an officer after he was denied ADA accommodations. A week after the story was published, Calloway withdrew from the selection process. Journalists are covering police constantly, and now is the moment to look back at these stories and think critically about the moment we're in today. Read your local papers. I recommend checking out Naomi Ishisaka's work. She's a longtime community journalist who's now a columnist at the Seattle Times. This week, her column discussed how city officials are trying to get out of their federally mandated oversight. In 2012, an investigation found SPD using an unconstitutional level of force, disproportionately targeting people of color. There's a long history of SPD falling in and out of compliance with the dissent decree, and now federal oversight may be terminated. These are the stories The Daily is thinking about and returning to in this time when conversations around police reform and accountability are more relevant than ever. Stay safe, look out for your friends, and good luck with finals, Huskies.